Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And the UK's fastest consumer broadband speed is about to hit nearly a quarter of a gigabit per second. Amazon has banned Apple TV and Google TV from sale. And we've got the latest Nexus phones from Google to review for you. But pick up a pen and put that on the later base. Because first this week, we are welcoming a guest some of you will know as the host of the video series Fully Charged, some as the man behind Crichton's rubber mask in Red Dwarf, and to some, both and more besides, possibly. It's Robert Llewellyn. Now, Elon Musk's electric car company Tesla revealed its Model X vehicle this week amidst a lot of cheering and futuristic door design. The company says this is its most advanced vehicle to date, reaching 60 miles per hour in 3.2 seconds, a top speed of 155 miles an hour, and a battery that lasts for 250 miles. It's got seven seats, a massive touchscreen, radar, sonar, and doors that automatically open when you approach it. It also costs 95,000 quid. So is this the future of automotive vehicles? Is it driving change to the industry? And if so, does the UK stand a chance of benefiting? Well, that's why I invited Robert to join the show this week, because not only is he an EV expert, he also drives a Tesla. I'm curious to get your thoughts on how significant you think the new Tesla model is in terms of advancing the EV industry as a whole.
I mean, I think I'm sure it does have a significance. And it's very specific. It's a very specific market. And that is a thing that I've come to learn from having a Model S. In the sense that I've never had in my life ever before a car that's that big and that sort of that makes that kind of impact. I've always driven little hatchbacks and small cars. So going from, say, a Golf or a Prius to a Leaf wasn't a big jump in terms of the scale of the vehicle you're driving. But going from a Leaf to a Tesla was a terrifying jump for me, and I haven't got over it and I'm still scared. Parking it is just terrifying. I haven't scratched it yet, but oh my God. And so I'm not used to big cars. I watched the Elon Musk presentation, which of course, as always, was, you know, very Jobsian in its sort of impact and drama and very well presented. And then I saw a Range Rover drive past our house, which there's thousands of them around where I live in Gloucestershire. And I went, oh God, now suddenly, or over in a moment, that car looks ancient, rubbish, old technology, great big heavy inefficient thing. And the people who can afford to buy that can afford to buy a Model X, and one hopes that some of them will.
Yes, absolutely. Now, how do you find the charging side of things in the UK with the Model S? Because I was having a look on a map that sort of showed, particularly around London, where the chargers are, and it doesn't seem to me to be quite as densely populated with chargers for those models as an equivalent area in, say, New York, in Manhattan, for example.
I mean, it's growing all the time. That's the one thing I've come to notice, that the map in the car updates. It seems to update faster than the map on the Tesla website. But I'm not absolutely sure. I bet they'll tell me that's not true. But I seem to notice them in the car. So so far, I haven't had to drive anywhere where I've had to go, oh God, I can't do that bit because there's no supercharger there. So that includes driving to Scotland, driving to Cornwall, obviously driving into London, driving to Europe. You know, it's easier than any other electric car I've ever had.
But that's because of the capacity. I know you had a Leaf before, which had a lower, or possibly still have the Leaf, and has a lower has a lower capacity than the Tesla. So, I mean, is that one of the things that's held us back in the UK? I'm curious to get your view on why the Teslas, apart from their cost, obviously, seems to have been the presence just hasn't seemed to be as great here as much as the PR around them.
No, I mean, I think they have shifted quite a few vehicles. I'm not sure how many are on the roads. I mean, I certainly see them quite regularly at the superchargers. That's where you tend to meet other Tesla owners. So there's one outside Oxford that's very popular that has, I think, eight charging stalls. And there's very often a couple of other Teslas there when I arrive at that one. So, you know, they are still rare as hen's teeth, but they are, you know, I think they're selling them. I mean, I just think it is a slow process because that any one individual Tesla owner infects his peers very rapidly. And that's what Tesla have relied on entirely. They've never spent a penny on advertising. So they just let their existing customers tell potential future customers about the car, you know, and you give someone a ride in it and there's no one who isn't overwhelmingly impressed with it when they go in it. Even if they're an absolute dyed in the wall petrol head, they go, oh my God, this is amazing. So I think it's partly down to that. And I certainly haven't felt the need to, I haven't even adjusted a journey to take in a supercharger in the UK yet, but I haven't done that many sort of, you know, long trips. There are certainly areas of the country where it appears there's none, East Anglia, for instance, but certainly the south of England seems to be very well catered for. I mean, they don't need to be as many as there are, as you would need for a Leaf, for very obvious reasons, because you can go a lot further.
I see. So maybe there's a slight chicken and egg scenario in that getting the Teslas over here, if they were here, it wouldn't be too much of a problem because the people who are using them don't actually have problems with them. Whereas for some people, their first experiences are with something more like a Leaf, where they may have run into problems with chargers or the support for those chargers not necessarily being 24/7 when they break down.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly the two stumbling points really for kind of mass adoption of electric cars are batteries and charging. You know, every other aspect of the technology works absolutely flawlessly. I mean, I've done 52,000 miles in my Leaf. It hasn't even had a vague fault, let alone broken down. It's just, you know, I just drive it. I don't even think about it. You know, so in terms of the motor and the drive system, it's as close to faultless as technology allows us. Where the drawbacks are obviously the battery and the range of the battery and then the charging infrastructure, which in the time I've had electric cars, which is now about 6 or 7 years, I've been driving them all the time, it has improved enormously. I mean, the change, you know, there was, when I first drove an electric car, there was one rapid charger in a private garage in Cirencester belonging to Mitsubishi. That was the only one in the country. And they used to let me use it. So I'd drive to Cirencester for no other reason than to use the rapid charger.
Yeah, that's not very sustainable, is it?
It isn't sustainable at all, you know. But gradually that's improved. So now, I mean, I went to a motorway services the other day somewhere up in Yorkshire, and they didn't have an Ecotricity rapid. They didn't have any rapid chargers. And that's quite unusual now to find one. So most of them do. So those journeys are now much more doable, but it's still a challenge because every now and then you're going to come across one. I've done it on the M25 late at night, stopped at the rapid charger without any, way, way before anything resembling range anxiety, and the thing wasn't working.
Wow.
And then you go, and then you work out, can I get to the next one? And I could just make it to the next one, which was working. But you've got, you know, so that for your general motorist that is thinking of changing, that's quite a challenge. And I'm used to it. I'm hardened to it. But that, you know, that would be a thing. But the idea that you might run out, for instance, that seems to be a very common fear that, you know, I might have the kids in the back and I'm driving along a country road at night and I'll run out. You would have to be illegal. It would have to be illegal for you to drive not to notice the enormous amount of information being shouted at you to tell you you might run out and you should stop. You know, the car is pinging, dinging, flashing lights for 30 or 40 miles before you're anywhere near running out. So you've got to be determined. I've made my car run out once because I wanted to see what happened. And the big surprise is it stopped.
Yes.
And so there is a sort of a fear based on lack of knowledge. You know, people don't know how the cars work. They're very well engineered to make sure that you can get to where you're going. The information in the car is very clear about that. So, you know, the Teslas, the sort of informatics on the Tesla are so advanced that you just go, oh my God, this car knows what I'm thinking. It's terrifying.
Wow.
Even before you've kind of decided your route, you're going, are you sure you want to go that far? You might need to supercharge on the way. as I'm putting the postcode in, you know, it's kind of worked it out already. So it's very, and that stuff is obviously going to get more and more sophisticated. So I think the mass adoption will bring about new technologies. I mean, induction charging being the most obvious. The more you see that, you will go, that'll work. Once that gets adopted and built into the cars automatically, it adds very little to the cost of the car. And that means you don't have to have a wire and a plug and a post. You just park it and it starts charging. You know, so once those things are set in car parks, which is happening in other countries, and in 10 years' time, we'll start doing it. You know, that will make a huge difference.
I can see that. I can see that being definitely a big change driver, if you sort of pardon the slight pun there.
Yeah.
And I can also see the advantage of something like the Leaf. You know, it's almost now then not surprising that they're popular within the cities because they are designed to do these sorts of short runs.
Yeah.
We need something like the Teslas here to be doing the long journeys outside of the cities, or longer journeys. And that in itself, as you say, there's kind of a word of mouth effect here that you can do that in some of the newer models. Maybe that in itself will spur more people to bring them over here and buy them over here, and that may then increase the demand and the need for people to actually build a business around installing more superchargers outside of the cities.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, but I also think that the what has been interesting, certainly if you look at other big motor manufacturers, so the companies that Tesla has taken a big bite out of their sales are developing 200 to 250 mile range electric cars very quickly. So BMW, Audi, Mercedes, Aston Martin, they're all bringing out pure electrics in the next couple of years because their sales have taken a dent. Because particularly in California, the sales of the Tesla have been phenomenal. Because if you can afford to buy a car that costs between 50 and 100,000 pounds, which I think is just incredible that there are that many people who can afford to do that, and you don't buy a Tesla, you're just paying that money and then paying a huge amount every week to fuel it. And in a Tesla, you're not.
So it's an investment. It's an investment.
It's definitely an investment. I mean, I've leased mine because I couldn't possibly afford to cough up that much money, and it's still quite difficult for me to maintain that. I've just paid for October and it's made a dent. But you know,
is that a model? I mean, is that a model that can work? I mean, the idea of renting cars, I mean, this seems like something where renting is very, very short term. You know, we'll rent one from an airport or for a few days or so, or you'll buy one, or you'll buy one on credit.
I mean, I truly think that the two things that I'm hoping and encouraging to have peaked are internal combustion engines and car ownership. And the internal combustion engines, for very obvious reasons, because there are increasingly viable alternatives, but they car ownership, I think, will become a thing of the past. That we'll still use cars and we'll still have access to them, and there'll be new models that bring about that easily. So the obvious one at the moment is obviously Uber, you know, which has become insanely popular globally in an incredibly short time. And there's loads of downsides to Uber, without question, but there is also an enormous upside, you know, in terms of ease of use. And ease of actually using it. And what you need is that frictionless experience, which I've only experienced in Berlin so far. I know it exists in other cities, but a car to go in Berlin, if you have a car to go system installed, it's actually on you use your driver's license. So if you're registered for it, you don't sort of think, oh, I've got to book a car on Tuesday because I might need to go to the shops, or what about next Thursday? I must remember to ring them up and book it and go and pick it up. You just go out in the street, there's a car, you put your license on the front, you get in it, you drive it, you leave it where you need to go. And that's the end of it. That's your relationship with that car has begun and ended with that. You don't need to own a car. You still use one. You know, there's tens of thousands of them in Berlin, and they're everywhere you go. And that made so much sense. And some of those were petrol cars, some were electric, some were not diesel, interestingly. I didn't remember a diesel one. You know, and then you go, well, if I lived in Berlin, I wouldn't dream of owning a car. It would be an insane thing to do, because you've got access to, you know, very well serviced cars that are generally already fueled when you get in them. You know, that whole system it needs to be developed, and that's a whole other business. And I think big manufacturers are also seeing that on the horizon, that they're not going to be necessarily selling cars to individuals. They'll be selling them to car clubs and car sharing systems in the most part.
Robert rejoins us later to talk more about the future of electric vehicles in the UK and Europe. Stay tuned for that after we discuss our highlights from the UK technology news pages of the past few days. Ian, I give a warm and hearty welcome to your voice.
Thank you. Very kind of you to say. I'm excited to be here again.
Good. I'm very pleased to hear that. Now, I want to talk about Amazon, which has done what one analyst described as a sledgehammer approach, or took a sledgehammer approach to online retail. This is what it has done. It has barred the sale of Apple TV and Google TV devices from its online store. The reason? Because they don't interact well with its own media service. The online retailer, according to the BBC, said it had made the decision to avoid customer confusion, and the devices will be removed from sale by the 29th of October. Basically, again, according to the Beeb, Amazon wants to sell products that work with its in-house streaming video service, Prime Video, which isn't available on Apple TV and Google's Chromecast. Now, this seems to me to be, I mean, the analyst described it as a sledgehammer approach to retail. It seems to me to be a giant middle finger to all of its customers, because they may have chosen not to use Amazon TV because they don't want to, and because they want to use an Apple or a Google product. And Amazon's saying, we don't even want your business because these companies, damn them, won't work with our technology. Does that not seem kind of anti-competitive, he says, with an admission that that is a very loaded question?
Yeah, I'm furious. I'm beside myself with rage about this, and I was extremely angry about it on Friday as well. You're absolutely right. Whether it's legally anti-competitive in the sense that it could be investigated for it, I don't know. I suspect there's no law compelling shops to sell one product or another.
No.
And it's entirely up to them. That said, the attempt by Amazon to mislead people by what it's saying, that statement that you said, we only want to sell products that can interact well with Amazon Prime Video, is so unbelievably stupid and so patronising. It left me beside myself with rage on Friday. And here's the thing. Amazon is the one that writes the apps for Android and such. And I wrote a piece for this on Forbes, where I went through the steps necessary to even watch Amazon Prime Video on an Android phone. It is an extremely difficult and irritating process. You have to download through the website, not through an app store, Amazon's own app store. Then you must download a Prime Video app, and then you're finally able to watch video on your phone. But of course, you can't cast it to Chromecast because that's a competing product and Amazon doesn't really want to support it. But we're not stocking these products because they don't play well with our product. Well, first of all, as you said, Nate, it doesn't matter necessarily if it plays well with their product. People don't go to Amazon to buy things necessarily that work with Amazon's other products. Amazon's falling into this trap, isn't it, where it thinks that it has this ecosystem that, you'd be better off if you just did Amazon, if you just forgot about everything else and just concentrated on Amazon. And that's just not the way the world works. Customers are usually pretty smart. They know what they want. They end up going to Amazon invariably because the pricing is good. There's probably little more to it than that. And, delivery is pretty good and quick. But it's this whole thing is just, it stinks. It really does.
Let's poke our head into the offal causing this stench. Because on the other side of the table, we have seen this happen from Apple. Now, Apple has kicked huge numbers of products, big, very successful, popular, well-selling products from its physical and online retail stores. Let's just recount some of those, shall we? Bose headphones, Fitbit, Nest, the Google now owned thermostat for modern homes, all kicked out of the store, arguably because they offer competing products. In the case of Bose, they bought Beats. In the case of Fitbit, they have the Apple Watch. There are lots of products here that get kicked out. Again, on the Apple side, if we're just going to play devil's advocate here, The App Store, unlike Amazon, is the only place to legitimately get Apple apps, and Apple will not even let people buy audiobooks from Amazon's Audible through its Audible app unless it gets 30% of the money from Audible. Therefore, you can download the app, but you have to go through the Safari web browser to buy the Audible books and then go back into the app and download them. It's a pain in the ass, and I say that not least because I'm a customer of both audible.com and audible.co.uk. So I have seen this happen on the other way around. The reason that this really irks me, and I'm assuming irks you as well to a large extent, Ian, is not so much because of the effect it's going to have on Apple or Google's ability to sell its products. Really, they don't need Amazon, those two companies in particular.
Well, particularly Apple. I mean, that's just not an issue, is it?
Yes. So,
I mean, in fact, I don't even know why you'd go to Amazon to buy an Apple TV, because it won't be any cheaper, will it?
No, but it's to do with convenience, delivery, blah, blah, blah. There's a whole lot of reasons to want to do that, older models perhaps. The whole fact is that for those two companies, they're very large and they're not dependent on Amazon. Other companies are, and they will rely on Amazon for almost all of their sales. And this sets a worrying precedent that if you are launching a product into Amazon, that Amazon may then launch a product that requires you support, then not supporting it or competing with it may see you get dropped from its store. And I think that sends an awful precedent for the biggest retailer in the world to do.
The other thing is, it's just awful, terrible
consumer experience. You're saying, come to us. You know, it's the Earth's largest selection. By the way, we're not going to sell anything that doesn't agree to work with our own products. And I think that's a terrible thing for customers to see.
Just to correct you, Nate, it's not that they won't work with Amazon. It's that Amazon chooses not to develop apps for those products in this particular case. And that's really the nub of what's annoyed me, is that Amazon has created a situation that it's then punishing, you know, both consumers and other companies for. I think it's reprehensible. And well, I mean, what can you say? It's a big business. Ultimately, there's nothing I can say that will change anything. But it annoys me greatly.
Well, I think that this is something that is likely to be undone to some extent in future. I can't see this being something that they want to continue doing because of the negative attention. And there's an irony in all of this that, you know, Amazon's Fire TV is built on Android, which Google makes. And I don't think that irony is lost on anyone. Certainly if it is, I hope I've helped you discover it in this wallowing pit of appalling consumer behavior marketing or whatever. podcast@natelangson.com is where you can send your opinion pigeons loaded with a belly full of observation. Send it to us. We will dissect that bird
and tear out the opinion.
In a clean and methodical way, and send the bird plastered up and back on its way for next week. podcast@natelangson.com. One more quick one I wanted to get to before we return to the second part of our chat with Robert Llewellyn, and of course the review that we've got coming up from Ian of the Nexus P. Not the P. What's it called?
Nexus 6P.
Thank you. Yeah, 6P, the new phone from Google, and of course your lovely, delightful, delicious feedback that's coming up. The news that we wanted to mention is that Virgin Media is launching something called Vivid, which is its new standard, so it claims, of ultra-fast broadband. And the key thing for us, you and I, Ian, I think, is because it means we can get speeds of up to 200 megabits per second. That is twice as fast as some people's Ethernet cables in their house are even capable of pushing from your router to your machine, let alone from the internet into your house. 200 megabits per second, that's up from about 152 megabits per second now. Now, the bonus is that it's not just for people who are on the very high tier of Virgin's cable products. It will affect most of the customers. So if you're on 50, 100, or 152 megabits, you will be bumped up for free to 70, 150, or 200 megabit per second speeds, respectively. Now, that is great. I got a letter through the door the other day that my broadband for Virgin is once again going up quite significantly higher than the annual rate of inflation. I sort of know that when I get a letter from Virgin, it's only ever, we're going to charge you more now. But by the way, we give you great speeds. And normally that really pisses me off. But I have to say, they timed this release quite nicely to sort of, pour some some water on my raging tempered skin, because 200 megabits per second down, that is bloody fast, and I sincerely hope that that comes with some faster upstream speeds as well.
It does not. And I, because I asked, well, I sort of asked, I tweeted about it, and they told me that no, there are no plans to currently to increase upstream. And then I wrote a piece about it saying how I thought that was absolutely ridiculous, and that the modern user really needs, you know, not comparable upload to download, certainly, I mean, the things that I do for my job, you know, uploading images, uploading videos, sending this podcast audio to you every week, you know, that's stuff that requires fast upload. And I think that the world has changed a lot in the last 5 years, and that upload is much more important than it ever was before.
Yes, I would agree. I think there are a couple of reservations. One is that typically it tends to be business packages that get the faster upload speeds, because it is aimed at, to be honest, people like you who quite often have a home office and need to do that. The average user probably doesn't need to upload that huge amount of content in the same way. But I agree that we're currently restricted to an incredibly small amount. My upload speed is about 16 megabits per second, compared to 152 down. And even though I don't need a business connection at home, I think getting somewhere like 50 or 60 megabits up would certainly help me move some of the big files around, particularly in this era of cloud-based storage, you know.
Exactly. I mean, this is the thing. You've got to remember people that you know, people with iPhones, you know, or any phone at all really that's set to back up to the cloud, you're doing that on your home Wi-Fi. It's okay, you don't notice it usually, but it's using a lot of upstream, and it's hampering other things you might be doing.
Yeah, I think it's changing. It's definitely changed the face, because, you know, even as I started that sentence, I was thinking more about it's file sharers who want to upload. But yeah, as I was continuing through the journey of that sentence, my feet stumbled upon an entirely contradictory view, which is that one about cloud based uploading. And with the iPhone and the Samsungs that we have now, and Sony's as well, recording 4K video, that's knocking on 300-400 megabytes per minute of 4K footage. We're talking gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes of potential video being captured, even by an average user over the course of a weekend, if you have a holiday or a party or something. And it's going to take you forever to upload that. So I agree. I've completely changed my view from being only moderately concerned to now, well, quite. I don't. Well, I'm sitting on the edge of my seat, like somebody in a, I don't know, high intensity cinema scenario, thinking this just will not stand. I won't stand for this. Well, if you won't stand for this, and I will remain seated here until Virgin changes its policy, do let us know your views. podcast@natelengson.com. Do you need faster upload? And key here, would you pay more for it? Because while I don't think I should, I probably would. And I imagine Ian would at least consider doing too, once he gets over the inevitable hurdle of anger and frustration. Well, very shortly, we're going to come to Ian's review of the new Nexus 6P phone. Very interesting device, the latest and greatest out of Google itself. That's coming up in a few minutes. But it's now time first to return to the subject of electric vehicles and Tesla with Robert Llewellyn. Thanks for staying with us, Robert.
Thank you. No, thanks for inviting me.
One of the conversations that I had with somebody around the time the VW scandal was kicking off was that Germany and countries that have very high outputs of internal combustion engines and cars, they have such a huge amount of their population embedded in the automotive industry that there's a resistance to changing that. And that may be one of the reasons why Europe hasn't seen the same level of electric vehicle take off as it has in other parts of the world. Now, I'm not close enough to the numbers and that knowledge to know whether that's accurate or not, but I believe you might be. Do you have a thought on that?
I mean, I certainly have thoughts on that. I mean, I've just been writing something about on this very topic, but because I don't envy them. I don't envy anyone who works in a large automotive company, because they're really in a cleft stick, because the engineers that work for them, and those are generally the people I have contact with, can build their e-Golf is a really good electric car. Their e-Up is one of my favorite electric cars I've ever driven, both made by Volkswagen. And they, you know, so they can make them. And then the questions that you start to ask are, well, hang on a minute, because if they actually advertise the e-up in the way that it needs to be pushed, they would say, this car is better than a petrol or diesel car because of this. And the list would be very long as to why it's better. It's much cheaper to run. It's hugely lower maintenance costs, which is a thing that a lot of people who've never driven electric cars don't quite fully understand, because there are no maintenance costs. The electric motor in an e-up would need a sort of service checkover probably once every 500,000 miles. So, wow. There isn't anything... There isn't anything moving it. There's only one moving part. It's incredibly simple technology. The Tesla motor needs to be checked once every 1,000,000 miles. So the car is never going to do 1,000,000 miles. The car will have fallen to bits long before the electric motor is packed up. So the difference in the running costs of an electric car are huge. Well, they can't advertise that, the big manufacturers. This is all of them, Nissan, Toyota, Volkswagen, all the people who make electric cars now can't really push that, because in doing so, they're denigrating the vast majority of their product. They're saying, we'll sell you this diesel car, but boy, will you spend a lot on catalytic converters, on filters, on oil changes, on fan belts, on timing stuff, on enormous amount of maintenance and spare parts those vehicles need to keep going, which we're all used to, which is normal. And so they can't really push it. The only two companies, I argue, that can really push the electric car agenda are BYD from China, because they don't make anything else. They make batteries and electric cars, and Tesla. So the boss of Tesla can say, diesels are rubbish. They produce lots of smoke, and they're really bad for you, and they release particulates, and they've been lying about it. He can say that, and he's not damaging his own business. The boss of Nissan or Tesla or the boss of Nissan or Volkswagen or anybody else can't say that, because they produce tens of thousands, if not millions, of diesel cars. So they're really in a pickle, and they, without question, that is holding back some of the real hard push to encourage people to at least try an electric vehicle. And that is really difficult to see, because I have contact with, obviously, the PR people from those companies who are pushing it, because that's their job. So they're very pro-electric cars. They're very keen on them. They're trying to get them out there. And I think, to be fair to Nissan, they're the one company that have really, jumped, really pushed it. And they built a car that was from the ground up an electric car, and that has proven its worth by selling, I think they've passed the 200,000 mark now globally, which for a completely new technology that you're constantly told in the press and by certain very well-known TV personalities in the automotive arena, are rubbish and they don't work and you're going to run out and you have to throw the batteries away and they kill children and all that stuff. You're fighting against a very big lobby. And, of course, the oil industry, who aren't going to remain quiet, because you do need oil to build an electric car, and you need a tiny amount to lubricate it. But we're talking probably a couple of pints.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it reminds me a little bit with the internal conflict of interest, if you like, that you mentioned with VW not being able to promote the electric cars so hard because it will damage
their
existing business. It reminds me an awful lot of what happened in the photography space, actually, where companies like Canon were making these digital SLRs that were suddenly making the camcorder side of the business almost irrelevant.
Yes.
and taking in the technology. And we've seen the same thing from Sony with its phones versus its compact cameras.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that, but to not do that is only limiting your ability to own and innovate in that market in the future.
Yeah.
And so it, to use my favorite word in the world, it behooves them to get over that and allow themselves to be cannibalized to a certain extent.
It certainly does. I mean, and I think that, that's been my plea with the Dieselgate thing, is that because it needs a dramatic, a management with a dramatic risk-taking attitude. So imagine if Volkswagen next week announced that they were going to stop the manufacture of diesel cars. Because I think that my argument has always been that diesel, there is a place for diesel in the current global economy because of trucks and buses and ships and diggers and all these things that kind of the diesel engine is ideally suited to. I've always argued that it's a ridiculous thing to put in a small passenger vehicle. It just is inappropriate and it's too polluting. And I don't care what anyone says about catalytic converters. I say they don't work, and the proof is in the air quality of our cities that's got worse in the last 20 years, not better.
Yes,
because of the increase in diesel cars. And if they said overnight, we're not going to make any more diesel cars from now on, we make petrol, hybrids, plug-in hybrids and electrics, would be an incredible boost to their business, not a destruction of their business. Everyone would go, oh, bloody hell, that's good. You know, they've taken this hideous shock. I was in Germany last week. There is an actual feeling in the air of kind of depression and guilt.
Wow.
You know, they're not as, you know, they're going, because it's just awful. And it's such a huge part of their national identity as well as their economy that's taken a real battering. I mean, that's not just a bit of a cough on the little bit of a blip in the graph. You know, they can't sell any cars in the United States. They can't sell any diesel cars. They're not allowed to.
And in the hunt that they have right now for the best PR story possible, coming out with a message that is, we're only going to make petrols, hybrids, yeah, plug-in hybrids, and electrics, would actually probably do a lot in their benefit.
It would do a lot. But, I mean,
maybe it's the right time to cannibalize themselves.
It is, but I think we both have to admit it's a massive and ridiculous pipe dream. I don't think they're going to do it.
Yeah, an exhaust pipe dream,
an
you may say.
An exhaust pipe dream, yeah.
Yes. Well, we've talked for a lot longer than I planned, which is, if anything, not a surprise, because I know it's a topic you're very passionate about and I'm extremely curious about. But to leave it on that note, is there any last thought that you have for people considering an electric vehicle in the UK that you would get out to them now?
I mean, I think the best thing to say is have a test drive of one. So if you know someone who's got one, see if you can have a ride in it, or see if they'll let you drive one, or go to a garage that has them. I mean, Nissan are very good with giving people Leafs for a test drive. You can book in a test drive for a Tesla, you know, if you're in that market. It's worth the experience, even if you're not going to buy one. And I think it's just to actually sit in one and go, oh, that's what it's like. I mean, it's become a cliche, but there is this thing which I've always found slightly annoying, but that people call the EV grin. But I've seen it dozens of times. So you see someone drive off looking a bit anxious and they're going, oh, weird, doesn't make a noise. They drive away, and then 10 minutes later they come back and they're grinning. And it is weird. And they go, wow, it's amazing. And you just go, I don't want the EV grin sounds like sort of really naff American marketing. But I've witnessed it with my own jaded Western European eyes. It does seem to happen. So I think it's worth a go in one if you can have a go in one. And then work out how you use a car, whether you really need one, whether you could live without one but rent them, you know, or, you know, depending on where you live. I mean, I live in the middle of the sticks, so our nearest shop is 7 miles. I have cycled there in the summer, but, you know, it's not something I want to do every day in the winter. So we do use cars, you know, for the most basic things out here. But if I lived in London, I wouldn't dream of owning a car. It would be insane. But I'd really want to have a good system around me that allowed me to use them when I needed them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can say I have been the I have given out the EV grin when I was recently driven in one of the new Leafs, in fact, just around the west of London, Ealing, where I live, and I did have to grin. It was a very nice experience.
I mean my argument is they're just a bit better than the old cars we're used to, you know. That's as simple as that. And there's lots of things. You know, there's lots of compromises and challenges you face with that new technology. But on the whole, I'd say that it's a better technology. Simple as that.
Definitely, definitely. All right. Well, that has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. Where should people be looking out for you next if they're curious about this topic or anything else that you're currently working on?
Well, if they're curious about this topic, then Fully Charged on a show called Fully Charged on YouTube, which is updated weekly, sometimes twice a week, depending on on the latest scandals coming out of the automotive industry, which is where I've sort of reviewed in my own, as some people have said, inimitable way just about every electric car that's ever been produced, and a lot of stuff about renewable energy and the energy matrix and where our energy comes from. So that's that show. I've just done an episode about electric cars and blind people with a blind man.
Wow.
It was great fun to make. He's an amazing man. It's worth watching that one. But then also, if you're interested in other aspects of nonsense that I do, there's two new series of Red Dwarf coming up in 2016. We're just about to start making it. So
that's fantastic. That's
old school telly, that is.
Yes.
Not well, media. Very old media.
As a big fan of both, I'd be looking forward to that. I'm sure a lot of listeners are as well. So Fully Charged, do check that out. It's a very long time show as well. It's been going for quite a number of years. Well worth a watch. And I'm going to check out the episode with the blind driver.
He's blind, black, and left-handed. So he claims he covers all the...
Wow.
All quarters.
Absolutely. A smorgasbord of quarters there.
Yeah.
And more Red Dwarf next year. Fantastic news. Robert Llewellyn, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Robert Llewellyn for joining us. Very, very good of him. Now, we have a review to get to, Mr. Ian Morris. And your review is for the Google Nexus 6P.
So last week, Google announced a pair of new phones, the Nexus 6P built by Huawei and the LG-made Nexus 5X. The larger, all-metal Nexus 6P seems like a more important device, so that's the phone I wanted to review in a little bit more detail here. Originally, and based on the leaks, I wasn't particularly sold on the design of the Nexus 6P. The all-metal design is pleasant, though, but I didn't really like that black camera housing on the back. In fact, though, when held in one's hand, it's actually a very nice phone. It feels high-end, although the price is just $449 for the 32GB model, which is pretty reasonable. The 64GB model costs $499, and the 128GB is $579. So the smart money is probably on the 64GB for the best possible value. Google highlighted a couple of things of which it's most proud. First, there's the fingerprint scanner, which Google has opted to brand the Nexus Imprint to keep the industrial jargon department busy. It's on the back and will unlock both the phone and allow you to pay with things with Android Pay. Like the iPhone, the fingerprint scanner now also allows you to use third-party apps, which is excellent news for people who don't like passwords very much. Following criticisms of the Nexus 5, perhaps, Google's also thrown a lot more effort into the camera. A new 1.55 micrometer sensor captures more light, according to Google, and so you should get better images indoors. The only problem I can really see is that lens remains f2.0, while Samsung has f1.9 and LG f1.8. These both increase the amount of light that can be captured by the sensor, so perhaps the Google results won't be any better than those phones. The screen is impressive too. It's an AMOLED, and it has a 1440p resolution, making it a touch better than a full HD screen. As always, big, high-resolution screens drain power fast, so perhaps that's why Google's put in the 3,450 mAh battery. That's bigger than the Note 4, which is considerably large. Going back to the camera briefly, the images on the Nexus 6P are captured by a 12.3-megapixel camera on the back that allows for 4K video recording too. On the front, there's a generous 8-megapixel camera that should really help narcissists take their never-ending stream of selfies. Google's also picked the Qualcomm Snapdragon 810 processor. These originally got quite a lot of heat for, producing too much heat, but Qualcomm maintains that was never really a problem. Even so, the 810 in the Nexus 6P is a revised version, running at 2GHz, and there's 3GB of RAM to back it up. That should help the phone run beautifully. The Nexus 6P and the 5X, for that matter, both feature USB-C connectors too, designed to be inserted either way up and to charge the phone quickly. It was mentioned as a somewhat important feature. In fact, I'm fairly irritated by it. There was no mention of USB 3, so it's fair to assume that these phones are just USB 2 with a new socket. That means that you'll have to get new cables to use it, and that's just rude. The move to USB-C was always going to happen, but I honestly don't see the rush, and I think it's sort of pointless if you don't move over to USB 3 at the same time. So the Nexus P was a lot better in person than it was in the leaks. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, really, and it is a strong pair of hands from Google, and it will be interesting to see how well this phone sells. I suspect that the 5X will be the better seller, as it's a little bit cheaper. It is, however, a good price for a mid-range phone, and the Nexus range has always been a somewhat niche market aimed at people who must have the latest unmodified Android OS on their phones, and for that market, there's little doubt that this phone is a good choice.
Ian Morris there, giving us his considered view of the new 6P. And of course, it goes without saying, he's here. I just asked him to do a separate review to really sort of condense the thoughts. So thanks for doing that, Ian. Now, it seems like you're generally quite impressed with the 6P, but there is room for improvement.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's always room for improvement, isn't there? I liked it. I did like it. I wasn't sold on the initial look of it. But, you know, look, I mean, it's got a great display. It's got a good battery. It's still has a lot of the problems that people were annoyed about with Samsung's phones, which is, you know, lack of removable battery and no microSD support. But Google just does not do those things. It hasn't for some time. MicroSD is something that I think Google really wants to get rid of. And again, I ultimately feel like the Nexus range is very limited in its appeal. I don't think they're phones for everyone. But that said, they're great when you get them.
So this that leads me to the one question that I have for you then. For someone listening to that thinking, well, that all sounds great. Is it for me? Who is the ideal person to consider getting the 6P? Like, what have they got now that makes them the perfect candidate for this phone over maybe most others?
Good question.
Thank you.
I don't know. I guess it would be someone with probably something built well. So maybe an HTC One or something. I mean, again, this the Nexus is a bit cheaper than a lot of the high end phones you might get from other manufacturers. So it does represent a pretty good deal.
And it's stock Android, which is a bonus over, say, Samsung's TouchWiz and Sony's equivalent.
Some people believe so, yes. I personally think those interfaces have got so much better over the last few years that they don't trouble me anymore. I used to go out of my mind trying to remove them, but actually these days I find them to be part of the handset. And, you know, like Apple goes to a lot of effort to make its phones work well with its software, I think that's sort of part of the Android ecosystem. Is
true,
that,
but in the sense that it's also generally more quick to receive updates from Google.
Yes.
You are getting the pure Google speedy experience when it comes to releasing new Androids.
Very true.
So we're saying it's somebody who went for something like the HTC One and really wants something that has the same sort of industrial design but with some of the better features for a little less money, but without the customization that Samsung or Sony will put on its phone, for better or for worse.
Or particularly HTC, because they're one of the biggest offenders for that.
Fair enough. Would that be a fair target market?
I think so. And I mean, also, you know, the pricing, which I've now immediately forgotten, it's pretty reasonable. And I think you might find people stepping up to that. So you may see people who were on budget phones previously who've enjoyed the Android experience and want to get something a little bit more high-end and think, actually, you know what, that's not a bad price. The only problem with Nexus devices is that they're not, as a rule, stocked in on normal service plans. So you have to hunt a bit harder for them. I don't know if that will change this time, but that has been the case in the past.
Well, let us know any other thoughts that you all have in your wonderful mind machines. Send them out through the medium of fingers onto any available keyboard and send them to our postbag, which is underneath the podcast at natelangson.com mail shoot. Don't know how I got through that massively convoluted way of explaining email without stumbling over my own ridiculous terminology. But there you go. That's where you can send it, podcast@natelangson.com. And as ever, please keep your cash in your pockets. Do not post them through our letterboxes, because the only payment that we need and accept is a review on iTunes. We are grateful for your cash. We know that some of you have suggested that you would pay us via Patreon or PayPal donations, and we're very grateful. But realistically, as we say every week, the biggest thing you can do to support the show is leave us those reviews in iTunes, or indeed in any podcast store, but in particular iTunes, just because of how many subscribers it gives us access to. Every review you leave gets us a little bit higher up in terms of charts and new and noteworthy and hot channels in those stores. So please do that. Let us know when you have done. We do keep our eye, but we can't look at every country store, rather. so I always appreciate being told. And I think on that note, and with once again thanks to Robert Llewellyn earlier on in today's programme, we will see you in Eine Woche.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.